a small comment on the first reading from Zechariah, which is famous, of course, because that's the one that Matthew uses in talking about what we call Palm Sunday. When it says he's going to get rid of God's going to get rid of the horses from Jerusalem, the horses were the war animals, basically. They were like tanks of an earlier time, and they were also the mode of conveyance of the aristocracy, too. So this is very much a pacifist, and wealthy kind of move that God spoke to me. But I'd like to talk about the second and third reading, because I think, quite by accident, the people who picked these two readings fixed on some issues that are really problematic, I think, in understanding what the whole Christian thing is about. I mean, if you look at the history of the church, there have been, or the churches, there have been massive and terribly harmful misconstructions of elements in both those texts, and that's what I'd like to try to address. So the passage from Matthew is more of this potpourri style, where he just sticks a whole bunch of sayings together sequentially and no order, no logical order. But it's his last couple lines that I'd like to talk about. Come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke. Everybody knows it. It shows up on sympathy cards and greeting cards. It's one of those texts that the Gideon Bibles have. If you want to feel good, then you go read that. And it clearly sounds as though, you know, God is a great anodyne here. If you're feeling bad, God's going to come and make you feel good. In other words, God stands, in a sense, as an agent outside my life who was there only to ameliorate the conditions of my life as I experienced them. But that's not what the text is about at all. What Matthew did was to take almost verbatim a couple of lines from one of the wisdom books and apply them to Jesus. That is, this text, come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, in its original setting, was spoken by Lady Wisdom, the wisdom of God, which in the Bible was kind of personified and given her own character, a literary conceit. So it's Lady Wisdom saying, come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart. Find rest for yourself, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. If we see this as wisdom, then I'd like to suggest the whole thing begins to look drastically different. God does not therefore become some just agent for self-improvement for me. And we can get to that, I think, most easily by asking how do we get to wisdom? How do we get to wisdom? Does someone else decide for us what is wise? I mean, those of us who are parents know endlessly, we talk to our kids, well, if you knew better, then you wouldn't do that. But that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about parental admonitions here. We're talking about adults talking to adults. And an adult recognizes wisdom only under her own steam. To see wisdom is a moment of recognition, a moment of self-illumination. It's not something totally from the outside pasted onto my consciousness. It's an awakening, as Krishnamurti was so fond of calling these moments. I see this to be the depth of the meaning of human life. I see it. I see it. And in seeing that, then all this other stuff comes into place. Your labor and your burden. Okay, that's the human condition, right? Bill Gates is labor and burden, too. The Enron CEO is labor and burden. We're all labor and burden. People dying of AIDS in Senegal are labor and burden. But to take the yoke of wisdom means that precisely that moment of recognition where I understand, I appropriate this understanding of life. In a very real sense, I live into that. I choose to direct. And therefore, I see consequences for that. Yeah, this is, I may find that to understand life truly, there's going to be difficulty. And that's the yoke of wisdom. To tell the truth, for example, to take a very simple example, it burdens. But we know in our better moments that that's wisdom. That's what human life is about. So God does not stand outside my life, but God is, as Augustine was fond of saying, more intimate to me than I am to myself. And I propose that radically revises our normal notion of religion, authority, dominance, etc., etc., etc. In other words, that very much underplayed theme of Catholic moral theology is in play here. Conscience. My conscience. It's the ultimate arbiter of my life. Being faithful to that conscience. And that, therefore, impinges on this whole business of flesh and spirit. Because here, too, we run into a big problem. If the problem in the past is that there's somebody out there who knows better about my life than me, which therefore would evacuate the whole business of wisdom that I just tried to talk about, then this business of flesh and spirit, understood as materiality, carnality, and something non-material, begins to look very different. Because Paul was not talking about the soul when he talked about spirit. Maybe we could take up that very common modern notion. I'm not religious, but I'm very spiritual. From the Christian point of view, there's a grain of truth in it. Let me back up. We have traditionally understood the war of flesh against spirit, against my sexual impulses and the higher me. Which accounts for what some wag has called pelvic theology, which is the hallmark of so much Catholic teaching, or has been in the past, and I think still is. Footnote. We had, in my seminary, we had to be 25 years old before we could even talk about sexual morality. 25 years old. Imagine. What did you do for the first 24 years? That's an interesting question. And most of us who are old enough or an early enough generation knew that we grew up being terrified of the fact that we had genitalia. And I'm not exaggerating in saying that. Many of us labored under that terrible burden of this misreading of these texts. It's the body, because if the flesh is in any place eloquent, explicit, is in precisely my sexuality. And it's the spirit that wars against that. Oh, no, it's not at all. The spirit, according to Paul, as a good Jew, as according to Jesus, is simply God's enlivening power for me to live a fuller human existence. Doesn't have anything to do with anti-carnal, anti-sexual sin. Nothing! So we can say to be a spiritual person is, in fact, precisely to let the center of one's life be animated by God. And then whatever sexual behavior follows from that will follow from that. But we don't start with the genitals first and then work our way up or down or whatever direction you want to think about it. Terribly important. Because even today, our sexual teaching, I think, is massively misconstrued. We either see sexual intercourse as this kind of ethereal joining of two persons, merging of two personalities. In other words, there's no sweat. There is no sweat in the sexual teaching that we get. If it's sweat, it's too nasty, smells bad, you know. It reeks of the human. So we have to angelize sexuality. We do enormous damage to people's self-understanding. Because where does wisdom lie? In dealing with my own sexuality. Just say no is what I learned. Just say no. Nancy Regan probably has some Irish Catholic background where she could adopt that slogan. Just say no.
No.
That's not what it's about. Not what it's about. So, a careful reading of these texts can be really what all religion is supposed to be, namely liberating. Liberating. Gives me my life. It gives me my life. And in a world where most of our lives are controlled by the police, the government, the Bank of Montreal, or Enron, or George Bush, or anybody else, the sense that ultimately my life truly is my own is good news, I think.